Hello and welcome. This is Fly Fishing Tales with me, John Howard. I started collecting these angling stories in 1998 when they were published on audio cassette along with copies of the flies my featured fishermen used. I'm now republishing some of these stories in longer form and as a podcast. Can't include the copies of the flies though, unfortunately. In this edition, I'm talking to Simon Kane, who came to Wiltshire in 1981 to follow in the footsteps of the legendary fly fisherman Frank Sawyer and cast his line on some of our most famous chalk streams. Not long after his arrival, he set up a bioengineering company specialising in river restoration and green engineering, which flourished as the quality of our chalk stream rivers declined, but their importance became increasingly recognised. For many tributaries and major waterways, Simon arrived in the nick of time. He began experimenting in how to revive these rivers and turn them back into the gin-clear havens of wildlife that many fly fishermen crave. He told me about the techniques for river restoration he developed, and I got him to do a little fishing along the way.
Just say a bit about where we are at the moment.
Well, we're on the banks of a very interesting site on the River Avon. This was part of an old water meadow system, and to our right, looking across the meadow, we've got a carrier coming in, which was the remnants of a redundant water meadow. And this rushing water that you can hear is the impounded sluice coming from the main River Avon. And those sluices actually back the River Avon up, back up the water, and that water then flows down a carrier, or a carriage, should I say, that's the correct term in water meadow terminology. A carriage takes water off the main river and delivers it downstream to the actual water meadow, where it is then passed across the meadows and then flows back into the carrier, which then takes the water back into the main river. That's where we are at the moment.
You've got a very interesting background in fishing. Tell me how it all came about and where you got interested in it.
Well, I was raised in the Caribbean. I had quite an exotic upbringing. And I suppose I must have been about 4 or 5 years old when we first came across American, the very earliest, I suppose, American tourists who came fishing for barracuda. And they were fishing off the jetty at Pigeon Point, which is a very famous location now in Tobago, but it was very deserted in those days. And of course, I used to watch them snagging bait fish under the shade of the jetty. So of course, we went along and said to them, do you mind if we actually snag fish for you? And they were absolutely delighted. By the end of the day, or within hours, there were, you know, the buckets were absolutely overflowing with sprats. So they gave us the excess fish, and we took them down to the beach, and we tossed them in flour and dropped them in corn oil onto a coconut husk fire and just ate them crispy straight out of the pan.
So, what about catching something while we have the chance? It's a warm, clear day in this part of Wiltshire, the water meadows flushed green from the spring showers, and when we've dipped a nymph or two in the rippling water, a good lunch in prospect.
Well, we're fishing the famous River Avon. I think they call it the Hampshire Avon, although we're several miles above Salisbury. So I think it's appropriate that we either fish with a killer bug or with a pheasant tail nymph in memory of Frank Sawyer. So I'm actually going to fish now with a size 14 killer bug, and see if we can get a grayling.
We'll return to that in just a moment, but this is also a great opportunity to hear about Simon's river restoration work. How did that all begin?
When I came back from my round-the-world travels, in 1981-82, I arrived in Salisbury. And, you know, I came down here specifically. I was inspired by reading, again, the book from Nymphs and the Trout by Frank Sawyer. And I came down here expecting to find that the rivers were in pristine condition. And, of course, I was quite shocked, having just come from some very pristine environments, and specifically I'd been in New Zealand, to find that there were quite a few problems on the streams down here. And of course, as the years went by, I witnessed dredging, all sorts of mismanagement, over-manicuring of the actual streams, pulling out brushwood where it should have been left, and a whole lot of management problems that were left over from the days of the water meadow system, where those meadows had just gone into disrepair. And nothing had really been done to bring about a change of use.
You talk about them being overmanaged. I'd like just a little bit of your views on that. Say something about that for me.
Well, we're sitting now looking at a stretch of river on the Upper Avon that is actually quite badly affected by the abstraction of a side stream feeding a water meadow. I was up here recently with somebody I work quite closely with, Alan Frake from the Environment Agency at Blandford, and we were discussing what we could do here to make a difference, to create an example of something which would truly represent a breakthrough in the whole attitude that the fishing fraternity and fishing managers have towards their rivers. And the fact is this, that recent research has shown that the highest density of insect life and of fish life is always associated or invariably associated with streams which have large or substantial volumes of woody debris. Now, the tradition has always been to make streams, and particularly chalk streams, as fishable as possible. So if you go down to the test, you'll even, I mean, that's an extreme, you'll see riverbanks looking like municipal gardens mown right down to the banks. Riparian vegetation, you know, the vegetation which grows at the margins has been cut back. Any sort of woody debris that catches up anglers' flies has been taken out. And so, relatively speaking, you've got quite a sterile type of environment there, one which is not all that conducive to encouraging, at least encouraging wild trout, which is what the work I do is all about. So in this particular stretch here, what we're going to do is to, what they call resection the river. We're going to actually redefine the shape of the river. We're going to narrow it in places. We're going to pinch it up immediately upstream of naturally shallow areas to try and get a flush of water going over what we hope will become a spawning area. And in certain places, we're going to cut down trees and we're going to bury whole logs into the river to create undercuts and areas which will harbour not just wild trout, but a whole variety of fish species. And so it's this sort of experimental, I suppose, groundbreaking work in a way that we want to carry out so it can be monitored, scientifically appraised, and perhaps that if there truly is some important lesson to be learned from this, that we can use that. Now I'm just fishing this off a gravel shelf. You need to have incredibly good eyesight to actually watch the monofilament leader as it swings around in the current, and the slightest movement, or if it stops dead in its tracks, you have to strike very quickly. And as I get older, I found this method of fishing increasingly difficult because one has to have a very acute sense of eyesight. But let's see. I fish all too seldom these days, but let's see if we can make something happen here. Of course, how I would normally approach a situation like this is I would fish it with a dry fly, and then I would probably go on to a sort of lighter nymph, probably a light pheasant tail, sort of 16 or 18 pheasant tail, and fish it fairly close to the surface. And then failing that, I would then fish as close to the bottom as possible with a heavier killer bug to try and get into the grayling. And of course the grayling lie on the bottom and they like to see the nymph approaching them at their level, and this is where this particular bug works really well, is you actually let it swing down in front of the fish, and probably sight fishing is by far the best way of doing this. And then when it gets in, when it arrives within a few inches in front of the fish, you have to raise your rod tip to make it look as though the nymph is actually trying to escape or rising to the surface to hatch out like a sedge pupa, which I think probably is what it imitates, although it's sometimes unkindly referred to as a maggot imitation. But having said that, they are very, very difficult to fish properly. Very good fun, nevertheless. But we don't seem to be doing very much here at the moment. Let's see if I can concentrate a bit more now. And of course, one of the things that you do need to have is a greased line. No. You know, I'll probably go onto a dry fly and catch a fish straight away. Yeah, it really is. Fly fishing is like anything else. It's a question of keeping in training.
When it comes to memorable catches...
Come on, Grayling. Where are you?
Today isn't going to make the record books, but Simon has plenty of great stories to fall back on. What would he pull out of his fishing bag as his most exciting catch?
Most of the most exciting fish have come as a complete and total surprise. And I remember, okay, I know people talk about the chalk streams the whole time, and people who fish on West Country or freestone streams will have to forgive me for repeating this story. But it was actually on a small stream called the Oakley Stream, which comes off the main River Test at Mottisfont. This particular stream is actually quite famous because of the oft-talked-about Halford's famous fishing hut. It's got wooden cladding on it and thatch, and roses growing up the walls. And at 4 o'clock sharp, the keeper comes along with cakes and tea. And I think that's terribly English, and I actually was part of the classic chalk stream fishing scene, so I remember that part of it as well. We were called off the river, no matter what, you've got to be here at 4 o'clock to have tea. Anyway, so that evening, it was an August moonlit night, and this particular trout was rising. I had no idea of how big the trout was, but all I knew was that I was going for it. It was rising so regularly, it was like almost like a sort of pendulum of a slow clock. Every 10, 15 seconds, the fish would come up, and it was obviously chomping on a real stream of spent coming down. And I cast. I must have cast 50 or 60 times to this fish, and of course, by this stage, it was so dark that I could not... I could only gauge the length of the leader, approximately where the fly was rising. And of course, the fish was rising at about 2 inches out from a great big chunk of cut weed or debris that was actually holding up on the side of the stream. And, you know, the cast had to be incredibly accurate to actually pass it over, because the fish was coming up and it was probably moving its head left and right, and beyond that it wouldn't take anything, no matter how perfect the presentation. And so eventually, every time I cast and I heard a rise, I would lift into the fish and nothing would happen. And I kept on doing this ad nauseam, almost to the point where I was thinking, well, I'm going to have to give this up because the fish is still rising. It's getting darker and darker. I'm never going to get this fish. It doesn't like my fly. The fly's not landing in the right place. And then I put the fly down for the last time and I lifted into it. And there was the most almighty crashing of water, and it just took off like an absolute torpedo. I mean, it was almost completely out of control, the fish. I was absolutely staggered by its strength, and it rushed around the pool. It went through weeds. I had a great big clump of cut weed on the line, and it was still running, and the line was coming off at an acute angle. You know, I think I must have been fishing only a 3-pound tippet, and it was by some incredible miracle that I got the fish in. And you know, my host Robert had disappeared. He was probably down at the car taking his tackle down and waiting for me to turn up, and thinking, well, I'm going to let Simon fish on until he drops. And you know, and I sat there with this, I don't know how big it was. It must have been about, anglers exaggerate, don't they? I mean, I was going to say that it was 6 pounds. Let's say it's 5 for the sake of argument. But it was, without a doubt, the most beautiful and the largest wild brown trout that I've ever caught in a chalk stream. And it lay there looking at me, and with its gills opening and closing. And I just held this thing in absolute amazement, just thinking, Robert, where are you? You've got to see this fish. It is so beautiful. The moon was shining on it. And I lowered it gently into the water, put its head underwater so it could breathe. And I just looked at it. I slipped the barbless hook and put its head upstream so it could just revive itself, because it had actually put up a hell of a battle. And then it just gently slipped out of my hands in the moonlight back into the dark water and disappeared. And that was a really special moment for me. There have been a lot of them, but that really was something special to catch a trout of that size wild in a very, very heavily stocked side stream of the River Test was, you know, I wish it could be like that for everybody.
One of the things we like our guests to do on Fly Fishing Tales is to let us into the secret of what tackle they were using when they caught their most memorable fish. So, Simon, what were you using when you caught that stunning brown trout?
I fish with a very long leader and a particularly long tippet, because I find that's a very successful way of deceiving particularly shy trout in rivers with very clear water. And by definition, irrespective of the size of the river, I will actually fish a longer than a shorter rod. I will normally scale down the line rating on the rod, a 3-weight or a 4-weight, absolutely maximum. And generally speaking, I will upload that rod with a line weight heavier. So if I fish with a 9-foot 3-weight, which is, I think was probably the rod that I was using then, which is why I had such an incredible battle from the fish, trying to control it on a 3-weight rod, with size 18 probably, Houghton Ruby on a barbless hook. Of course, Frank Sawyer was legendary for approaching a shoal of grayling. And, oh, you hear that? I actually snapped up on one. Too much talking, not enough concentration. Lost my nymph. Damn it. But it wouldn't be fishing without it, would it?
Very good, very good.
Which is just bad luck.
You concentrate this time, Simon. I'll just record the sound of it.
Okay, there we are.
Is it a grayling?
It should be a grayling on a killer bug. But no, it's a little wild trout. Oh dear. We were supposed to get a grayling. It's a lovely trout, that. I think anglers have a problem recognising or knowing what a wild trout is. Now, if you look at those pectoral fins, apart from the colour of the fish, they are absolutely perfect. Like the wings of a Spitfire. That's something to look for. Of course, now the fish really took that fly in. Let me just...
You concentrate on doing that for a minute.
Yeah. In the event that I have a problem unhooking a fly, always fish barbless, and rather than cause any distress to the fish, just release it. There he goes. And they will shed the hook very, very quickly, rather than actually poking around trying to get it out. So I just cut it off and put them back in, and it will just slide out. They just breathe water in and out of their mouths and flush the fly out.
That's a good tip.
That was my morning with Simon Kane. Many thanks to him. His river restoration company is called Kane Bioengineering, based in Braymore in Hampshire. That's Fly Fishing Tales. I'm John Howard. Join us again next time.